Hello, welcome back to Slut PhD. I'm your host, Julie Fennell, and in today's episode, I will be reading from my book, Violated, Sexual Consent and Assault in the 21st Century, which I published with Remy Green in 2024, published by Littleman and Rofield. At present, there is no audiobook recording of this book, so I thought that I would at least try to get the first chapter recorded for those of you who are very interested in it, and perhaps some of you might be motivated to actually go read the book. In forthcoming episodes soon, I will be talking at great length with Remy about our book. There's a lot to say about it. It's a topic we're both very passionate about. We worked on it for years together, and so we care a lot about it. But for now, I'm just going to read to you from it. Preface. Since you've picked up this book, chances are you're personally invested in sexual assault prevention for one reason or another. Maybe you or someone you care about has been sexually assaulted. Statistically speaking, you'd have to have a pretty limited social circle not to know someone who has experienced sexual assault. Maybe you're coming at this from the other side. You think you've callously or unintentionally hurt someone else, or are worried that you might in the future, and are hoping to become more reflexive. Or maybe you're just a little weary of the consent conversation you're used to hearing, and are hoping this book does what it advertises and gives you something fresh to think about and talk about with the people who matter to you. Maybe you're none of these things, and I'm just projecting different aspects of myself onto my readers, because to tell you the truth at the outset, I am all of those things at once, and perhaps you are as well. I've had my consent violated, I've been terrified of violating others' consent, and I also desperately want the conversation my friends are having about consent to change. I may as well come out here at the beginning and say that I'm pansexual, meaning I've had sex with people with a wide range of genders and bodies. As a woman propositioning both women and men, I'd have to be really oblivious not to notice the staggeringly different ways men and women learn to talk about, ask for, and get sex. And once you start noticing those differences, it's kind of hard to stop. My co-author, Remy Green, who uses the gender-neutral pronoun they, meanwhile, is queer, trans, and assigned male at birth, meaning in this case that they were raised to be a man and came to early adulthood presenting that way, but have since transitioned to become increasingly feminine over time. Remy and I have a broad range of experiences in negotiating sex, sexuality, and consent, and those experiences have taught us that our cultural discourse about those things is deeply and problematically heteronormative, which is just a fancy way of saying people tend to look at this issue only from the perspective of straight people. With this book, Remy and I are hoping to violate some of your core expectations about consent and sexual assault, encouraging you to think way outside the box and look at those things in ways that you may have never looked at them before. A quick note about language conventions here. Like many writers on this topic, I choose to ruthlessly alternate between the words survivor and victim because so many agencies that deal with sexual assault use different words. Usually, I'll use victim when I'm talking about statistical experiences and survivor when I'm talking about psychosocial elements. I don't think there's a right word here. Our language and culture are both still in flux and in contention. Similarly, there's no easy language convention to talk about sex and gender. Here I have made the same awkward choice as many writers for predominantly straight audiences, using women and men as a shorthand for cis women and cis men, meaning people who identify with their gender of their sex assigned at birth. Neither I nor my co-author loves this linguistic choice, but I'm assuming most of my readers are from a heterosexual cultural context that expects this convention. The topics I'm covering in this book are messy. They're legally messy, they're socially messy, and they're psychologically messy. If you're coming to this book as a survivor, I hope you will only use this book in a way that is healthy for you. As the author and a fellow survivor, I give you permission, indeed I encourage you, from the start, to skim over things that aren't good for you and to get to the parts that are. This book isn't a self-help book for individuals, and it's not intended as cathartic reading, although I would be very happy to learn that it was for some. I'm particularly worried that some people reading this book may feel like I'm occasionally blasé about the seriousness of many consent violations and sexual assaults. But I'm trusting at the outset that you're smart enough to know that plenty of consent violations are black and white stories. I've experienced a couple myself, where one person is wrong and the other was wronged. The end. So instead of walking you through a set of incredibly simplistic moral, legal, and philosophical facts I'm assuming you're already on board with by virtue of being a decent human being, I'm going to delve right into the murky gray stuff that ends up muddying those black and white stories by association. I'm going to respect you enough as a reader to believe that you don't need me to tell you that having sex with someone who's saying no is wrong, and that it happens far too often. I hope you'll respect me enough as a writer and thinker to believe I know that too. Instead of being a self-help book for individuals, this book is a self-help book for society and the law. And if you imagine all the work it might take to help you change yourself in whatever ways you want, then multiply that by everyone in the country, you might get some sense of how much harder it is to fix society than it is to fix just yourself. On the other hand, you have a lot more people to help you do it. So let's do it together. Part 1. How did we get here? Chapter 1. Quantum Consent. Once upon a time, a gay friend of mine, I'll call Al, found himself in an awkward situation. He was staying in a packed RV out of town, but all his, also gay, roommates for the weekend were out. Al was completely sober and trying to sleep in the top bunk when his roommate Bob, who Al barely knew, came in, drunkenly stumbling into the bottom bunk. Al really just wanted to go to sleep, but Bob was in no mood to sleep. Bob was as insistent as only the very drunk can be that Al should fuck him, despite the fact that they had never done anything sexual before. Desperate to go to sleep, Al finally gave in to Bob's demands for sex. When Al tells the story, he gets a vengeful gleam in his eye when he notes that the only condom he could find was a Rough Rider, the viciously textured kind, and no lube. Al briefly fucked Bob before Bob finally passed out. It's unclear to me, as I think it was to the teetotaling Al, whether Bob actually passed out or if he simply fell asleep. When Al initially told me this story, he was clearly full of resentment and frustration about what had occurred. As he continued the story, my mouth dropped further and further open until I finally said, with more than a hint of uncertainty in my voice, "I'm so sorry you were raped? I'm not sure what to call that, but whatever it was, I'm sorry it happened to you. I just wanted to go to sleep," he complained. Al's story is bad for a variety of reasons, but it's painfully illustrative of the ways our culture inconsistently assigns blame and victimhood in experiences of sexual assault. And it's also painfully illustrative of how people in our culture experience such events. Our culture tells us that Al, being sober, is supposed to be the person who rationally rejects a drunk person's relentless sexual advances, which means he was the violator, not the violated. Especially since Al fucked Bob into apparent unconsciousness, Bob doesn't come off as someone who was really aware of what he was doing. Moreover, because he was the person doing the penetrating, our culture tends to assume Al had more power in the scenario, especially when it came to the power to make it stop, again framing Al as the violator. On the other hand, we also frame relentless sexual advances from drunk or sober men as harassment, which would make Bob the violator. But perhaps the messiest complication of all is that we don't talk much as a culture about what sexual assault looks like between two men, who we tend to assume always want sex no matter what they say. If they didn't want it, their dicks wouldn't be hard, right? Wrong. This story becomes even more revealing of our cultural inadequacies if we alter certain details of it. If, for example, both men had been about equally drunk, I'm not sure we would know what to make of the scenario. If one drunk man pressured another drunk man into fucking him, I don't think our response would be particularly indignant or strong. On the other hand, if sober Al had been the tremendously reluctant recipient of drunken Bob's lubeless Rough Rider condom, I believe that as a culture we would be much more likely to perceive Al as the victim of a sexual assault. The situation becomes even more dizzying when we leave absolutely everything else about the story the same, with slight changes in sexual orientation. Imagine sober Al was straight and drunk gay Bob had pressured him into fucking him. I think we immediately consider the situation much more rapey, while simultaneously quietly doubting the truth of Al's heterosexuality, when we think a man's sexuality was violated on top of his consent. And perhaps even more complex, imagine straight, drunk Bob had pressured gay, sober Al into fucking him. I believe we instinctively add a false narrative to this version where we assume that gay Al must have been making token protestations but was actually pleased at the opportunity to have sex with a straight man, while straight Bob just needed to get drunk in order to be willing to have sex with a man. Notice that none of these stories have altered the fundamental fact that one person pressured another one into having sex, but intoxication, gender, sexuality, and sexual roles interact in complex ways to affect our assessment of the situation and who was violated. The previous versions are pretty complicated, but let's try playing the same basic story out with different genders and see if we respond differently. I doubt our responses change much if drunk lesbian Bianca pressures sober lesbian Amy into fucking her. I suspect that culturally we tend to view the situation as less serious because we tend to think that lesbian sex is less real, but the rest of the assumptions hold. However, if we change the story so that drunk straight Bridget pressures sober straight Andy into fucking her, I think our reactions tend to shift dramatically. Our culture typically claims that drunk or sober men should resist the sexual advances of drunk women because the women can't consent or don't know what they're doing. In particular, the idea or image of a man having sex with a woman who is passed out drunk is constantly held up as a model for a classic fraternity rapist. Change the intoxication here, and we still tend to think of this as Andy's fault. If drunk Andy pressures sober Bridget into letting him fuck her, and possibly even if he pressures her into fucking him with a strap on, I think we're pretty likely to see Bridget as the victim. As with the two men, things get weirder here if we throw sexual orientation into the mix. As long as the drunk person is gay, I think we're kind of okay with what happens. Drunk lesbian Bridget pressures straight sober Andy into sex, or drunk gay Andy pressures straight sober Bridget into sex, because again, for some reason, we start drifting into the illusion that sexual orientation is related to sexual consent here. If we switch it so that the drunk person is straight, however, I think we respond to the situation much more negatively. Drunk straight Bridget pressures sober gay Andy into sex, and much worse if drunk straight Andy pressures sober lesbian Bridget into sex. Before going further, it's important for me to pause here and say that when I talk about these cultural tendencies, I'm not necessarily talking at all about what people actually think. For example, statistically speaking, if you're a college-educated straight woman, you're more likely to, at least claim that you, view those scenarios as similar to each other than if you're a college-educated straight man who's much less likely to be sympathetic toward a gay male victim than a straight female victim. I'm talking more about what the media, broader cultural discourse, and maybe even our peers and respected others tell us we're supposed to think. I'm sure plenty of people reading this had only one reaction to the story of Al and Bob, that gay sex is gross and immoral, and that consent is irrelevant to the ick factor, although I don't know how many of them will have kept reading as far as this paragraph. Meanwhile, I'm pretty sure a lot of people reading about Bridget and Andy assume that in all the situations, Bridget was clearly asking for it because she was slutty enough to be rooming with a guy in the first place. But because these people know the answers that are culturally expected of them, there's a decent chance that in polite society or on a survey, they'll still give the right, aka socially desirable, answers. Al was in a tricky situation, or Andy took advantage of Bridget. And that, dear readers, is where things get really messy. Because it turns out that especially when it comes to sex, what people say they believe and what they actually do are sometimes wildly at odds. Historically, our culture has maintained a sexual double standard that favors men with regard to numbers. Men are allowed to have sex with as many women as they want without suffering social judgment, but women are penalized for having sex with too many men. Note that there's a parallel orientation double standard that favors women. Women are allowed to have drunk sex with a lot of women and still label themselves straight, but men who have any sex with men, drunk or sober, get labeled gay. But in the last couple of decades, as I'll explain in much more detail later, at least in educated liberal circles, the superficial evidence overwhelmingly suggests that both men and women have shifted toward a reverse sexual double standard. That reversal means if you ask for people's opinions on a survey or in response to an abstract situation, they tend to be more negative about men having a lot of sex partners than they are about women. However, when you head out into the real world and actually talk with people about how they interact and what they really do, it's viciously clear that both men and women still judge women much more negatively than men for the same kinds of sexual exploits and experiences. Thus, it's entirely possible that we say Andy should be held accountable for taking advantage of Bridget, while simultaneously thinking, gee, I hope my son doesn't marry a girl like that, and imagining accountability to be a brief scolding. When we're faced with real-world people instead of abstract vignettes, all of Andy's friends might decide that Bridget is a conniving bitch, for example, while all of Bridget's friends might think Andy is a rapey asshole. Or maybe both Bridget and Andy were too embarrassed to tell any of their friends about what happened at all. These scenarios introduce many of the themes we'll discuss throughout the rest of this book. A lack of vocabulary to articulate and describe experiences of sexual assault, gender roles, biological sex roles, sexual power, intoxication, shame and stigma, communication failures, and complex ambiguities in consent and assault, and finally, the utter failure of the current legal system to manage these complexities. Most of all, I hope you see a theme of what I'll call quantum consent, meaning consent often isn't a simple yes or no proposition. In physics, a quantum effect, very, very simplistically, refers to the idea that we can change matter simply by observing it. Famously, depending on your perspective, light can be either a particle or a wave. Attempt to interact with it, and suddenly it will flip from wave to particle or particle to wave. Much like quantum matter, consent seems straightforward and easy until we actually try to look at it head on, and then it starts getting messy quickly. In most of the scenarios I've just described, the Al character technically agreed to what happened. But do we think they really gave meaningful consent? And from whose perspective should we evaluate that question? Al's? Bob/Bridget's? A neutral observer's? Moreover, we've seen it's easy to misinterpret consent differently in those scenarios depending on the gender, orientation, and sexual role of the person giving it. But theoretically, consent is supposed to be universally applicable and objectively knowable. So what happens if it really isn't? Rather than try to brush off the complexities of consent, this book is going to embrace them. Instead of saying, well, this is too complicated, so I guess we'll just never know if this is a particle or a wave, I'm going to accept the quantum nature of consent as one of its fundamental properties, and then use that to explore how we can improve social and cultural standards, as well as both civil and criminal law. If you're hoping for a few quick takeaway messages with simple solutions, you're probably going to be disappointed. Anyone who tells you solving our social problems with consent and sexual assault is easy, just tell men not to rape, or just tell women not to drink so much, probably doesn't really understand the nature of the problem. There are lots of pretty simple solutions that would make a huge difference in dealing with sexual assault that get as far as the police, like, say, actually bothering to test rape kits, which forensic investigators only occasionally do. But in order to actually implement those solutions, there are a lot of questions we need to be asking ourselves first, like whether and when we want the police and courts involved in sexual assault at all. And especially when a solution is blindingly obvious and simple, we need to ask, well, why isn't it happening? The sources of our problems go deep into broader issues of sexual shame, gender inequality, alcohol, drug use, education and communication, and outdated laws. Moreover, the problems are disconcertingly similar across many different social and cultural contexts, including in places where gender equality and sexual education are actually pretty darn good, Iceland, as well as ones where gender equality is fine and sexual education is terrible by the standards of the industrial world, the United States. When a problem is that vast in scope, we have to look for multiple complex structural solutions to it, not just pithy slogans to go on billboards. What exactly is the problem? If you've read this far, I assume that at least on some level, you're on board with the idea that your social circle slash society slash culture has a collection of related social problems around sexual consent and assault. Even though the countless academics, lawyers, journalists, and social commentators who've written about these issues pretty much all seem to agree that there is a collection of problems, they seem at best to have arrived at a mediocre consensus about what those problems are. Most writers start from the premise that the fundamental problem is that too many women experience sexual violence from men and that our culture doesn't take the devastation and criminality of those experiences seriously. That premise feels intuitively appealing and often initially looks like it's backed up by statistics, until we start digging beyond the surface and asking harder questions like, what do we really mean by sexual violence? Is sexual violence being kissed when you didn't want to be? Or does it have to be more overtly sexual than that? Does sexual violence include experiences like that of Al, where someone gets pressured into saying yes to sexual activities they didn't want? Or does it only include activities someone always said no to? What about sexual activities someone said neither yes nor no to? And most of all, although generally ignored in this debate, what about sexual activities that occurred while both people were intoxicated? Which, as far as scholars can tell, seems to be the vast majority of non-consensual sex. If both people are really, really drunk, who's responsible for getting and giving consent? You might reasonably be thinking, sure, but even if we narrow down the concept of sexual violence to include only the most unequivocal examples of sexual assault, we're still going to find that most of the victims are women and most of the perpetrators are men. Perhaps. Especially if we look at crimes of non-sexual violence. Around the world, nearly all are committed by men between the ages of 16 and 24. So it stands to reason that crimes which include both non-sexual violence, e.g. beating and weapons, and sexual violence would probably also be committed by this same group. And the statistical majority of these offenders are almost certainly heterosexually attracted, because most people are. I'll use existing legal terminology to refer to this type of crime that includes both sexual and non-sexual violence as aggravated sexual assault. I don't think there's an easy answer to the question of whether these aggravated sexual assaults are simply another type of violence, along with robbery, assault and battery, and homicide, or whether they're at the far end of a continuum that includes the drunk guy who just keeps ruthlessly having sex with a drunk girl who says stop. Regardless of how we instinctively want to categorize such crimes, I think the very limited research suggests that aggravated sexual assaults are much more likely to conform to the old feminist aphorism that rape isn't aggressive sexuality, it's sexualized aggression, than the drunk guy who doesn't stop when he's supposed to. Equally tentatively, I think the evidence we have suggests that those drunken, non-consensual sexual encounters mentioned earlier are actually mostly aggressive sexuality and not sexualized aggression. So if they have such different underlying motivations, do they even count as the same social problem? Do they have the same solutions? We'll explore these questions throughout the book with the general answer of sort of yes, but mostly no. Once we exclude aggravated sexual assaults, we might find that most of the remaining sexual violence starts looking a lot less like how we usually imagine violent crimes. But if men are the ones mostly responsible for violent crimes, and most sexual violence isn't actually so quote-unquote violent, there's a very real possibility that women might be committing acts of sexual violence a lot more than we expect. And indeed, much ignored data on sexual assault collected in the United States by respected nationally representative agencies such as the Centers for Disease Control grimly support this perspective. These data find eerily similar numbers of adult women and men reporting experiences of forced slash unwanted sex in the last year, and contrary to expectations, most of men's unwanted sex happens at the hands of women. Indeed, even the stereotype of prison sexual assault pitting a male inmate against another male inmate appears to be misinformed, with research finding that female staff are actually quite likely to perpetrate sexual assaults against both male and female prisoners, and female prisoners are more likely to sexually assault one another than male prisoners are. I realize this information utterly contradicts most of what you've always heard, and I promise I'll spend a lot more time going over it in Chapter 3. Other numbers I'll go over in Chapter 7 will show that at present there is no statistical evidence that race significantly affects any quantifiably measured aspect of sexual assault, but being a bisexual woman vastly increases someone's odds of being assaulted and not being taken seriously by the police. I know some of these numbers can be hard to swallow. I spent months uncomfortably digesting many of them myself. So I want you to start getting a sense here at the outset for the way that you may have misunderstood and been misled about the nature of sexual violation. I warned you earlier that this book was going to embrace all the ambiguities and complexities around consent and sexual assault. So if you're feeling a little overwhelmed right now, don't worry, I am too. The scope of the problem is much more complicated and rather different than we've generally been led to believe. Despite all those complications, the goal of this book is relatively straightforward: to propose social, cultural, and legal changes that should help reduce non-consensual sex and create better strategies for addressing it when it happens. Going Rogue, the Me Too Movement. By 2017, it felt like the world was paying attention to all of these issues in a way it never had before. That year, the Me Too movement exploded around the world as women on the internet and in real life began sharing depressingly similar stories of sexual harassment and assault at the hands of men, especially men in positions of power over them. Media and culture both seemed shocked that so many women had endured sexual violations from men who apparently never suffered any real consequences for them. Although it went largely unnoticed, this cultural earthquake had actually been preceded over the previous several years by a number of foreshocks in intriguingly disparate places: college campuses, the porn industry, and the BDSM, bondage and discipline, dominance and submission, sadism and masochism subculture. In all those original pockets, as in the eventual larger mainstream movement, women usually began by calling out a male violator on social media, especially Twitter, publicly shaming him and demanding that others join her in doing so. As the movement progressed, some men were arrested and charged with actual crimes. Others lost high-profile jobs, seemingly for good. Others briefly retired into obscurity, only to return once the initial outrage died down. And many others suffered no material consequences at all. Underlying this strategy of publicly shaming, calling out, was the belief that conventional social institutions, particularly the criminal justice system, would dismiss or disregard these complaints as lies or say that they did not meet the sometimes demanding criteria for criminal sexual assault. None of the women making the initial complaints in 2014 to 15 fit an easy conventional social profile as victims of sexual violence. Emma Sulkowitz, a college student at Columbia University, alleged that a fellow student had anally raped her after the pair had engaged in consensual oral and vaginal sex. Columbia refused to punish the accused man despite her repeated demands. At almost exactly the same time, Stoya, a popular feminist porn star, posted accusations of abuse online against her long-term porn star, now ex-boyfriend James Dean. Other female porn stars also made accusations of sexual abuse against Dean, at least one about their private relationship and another about an interaction that should have been professional on set. And then, in the land of BDSM, a socially prominent rope bottom, someone who gets tied up, named Gorgone, posted accusations on the internet against a prominent male rope top, someone who ties people up. During a performance, while tying her, he had fingered her without her consent. Once her accusation became public, it became apparent he had been making a habit of doing the same thing to a number of women for many years. These stories felt uncomfortably ambiguous to many of the people reading them, although clearly not to the people who had lived them, as by their own accounts, the victims/survivors had all started off in consensual sexual or erotic interactions, with a boundary or 10 eventually being crossed. The bulk of the evidence indicates it's depressingly difficult to get legal authorities to pay attention to instances of sexual violation where there was ever any hint of consensual interaction. Basically, once someone has consented to some sexual or erotic interaction, authorities seem to have little patience for the idea that any violation has occurred. These women were all staking a claim for much firmer boundaries than society had historically granted them, arguing in the strongest possible way that no means no, and that consenting to a particular sexual or erotic interaction with someone doesn't translate to consenting to every sexual or erotic interaction with them. The truth of that statement seems self-evident, but these women were demanding something else as well: social censure and serious consequences for men they said hadn't understood and respected their boundaries. Emma wanted her alleged violator expelled from school, Stoya wanted James Dean fired from the porn industry, and Gorgone wanted her alleged violator expelled from the BDSM community. Colombia refused to expel Emma's alleged violator. Many prominent porn companies very publicly broke with Dean, although many didn't, and the BDSM community kicked out Gorgon's alleged violator. These women framed their concerns as public matters deserving public sanctions, not just private quarrels and hurts. And semi-explicit in their accusations was the threat that if these men weren't properly sanctioned, it eventually transpired that all of them had at least one other accusation leveled against them, they'd just keep hurting other people. You might reasonably wonder why I've started my history of the Me Too movement so differently than the Wikipedia entry. That article, as I expect most encyclopedia articles will continue to do, traces the beginning of the movement to the revelation that Harvey Weinstein, one of the most prominent producers in Hollywood and a staunch liberal, had been sexually abusing women for decades. Many of those women, not so coincidentally, happened to be movie stars. I've gone back further because I think focusing on Weinstein gives the wrong impression of the shape of the Me Too movement, which was fundamentally a grassroots effort and always more closely resembled an internet mob than a well-organized social movement. Before you get too angry at my choice of the word mob, let me hasten to quote Martin Luther King Jr., who wisely said that a riot is the language of the unheard. Weinstein, unlike nearly all of the men who eventually got Me Too'd, the verb that emerged for men, especially more powerful ones who were publicly accused of sexual harassment and abuse, ultimately faced criminal charges, was found guilty, and was penalized. Moreover, the evidence against him was unequivocally damning and overwhelming, coming from multiple sources who all had considerable social prominence themselves. Although the high-profile cases of powerful men sexually harassing and abusing their female employees sometimes echoed what had happened with Weinstein, most of the rest of the Me Too movement didn't really fit that profile. Instead, the stories that emerged again and again more closely resembled those of the women who called out their abusers in those initial pre-2017 public shaming rituals. These stories and activists were challenging society to reshape its vision of what a victim-survivor of sexual violence looked like to encompass anyone who had had a serious boundary crossed, not just the traditional understanding of rape that included only sober women who were violently raped by a stranger in an alley. And they were also arguing that if traditional social institutions like the law continued to fail them, they were going to seek alternative forms of sanction and redress, typically in the form of public shame. But the court of public opinion is notoriously fickle and possibly even more unreliable than dubiously reliable juries. Moreover, this unofficial court was in no position to mete out consistent, continuous, or equitable punishments. The court of public opinion was in a terrible position to decide how long someone deserved to be expelled from the good graces of society for any particular offense, and it lacked a coherent system for enforcing that expulsion or for reliably determining whether the accusation leveled against someone was fair and reasonable. In effect, the thrust of the Me Too movement became, "Our institutions of justice have failed us and will continue to fail us, but we still hurt, so we ask you, our society, to grant us a different kind of justice." And to greater and lesser degrees, parts of society did, at least for a little while. But I think that's a deeply problematic goal for a social movement aimed at trying to reform problems associated with sexual violation. Breaking faith with basic social institutions like the law encourages an atmosphere of intense social distrust, which is bad for society at the interpersonal level as well as the broader institutional level. In particular, breaking faith with core social institutions makes it harder for people to trust each other in everyday interactions, and it makes it harder for people to trust their governments and institutions of authority. And while blind faith in the government is a terrible way for any democracy to function, a reasonable degree of trust is necessary to have a functional society. As citizens and as people who just want to live amicably with one another, we can't afford to simply disregard the importance of the law and other institutional authorities. I admit there's good cause to be concerned that trying to reform rape laws might be futile. Hotly debated, but discouraging international evidence suggests that after rape law reforms in the 1990s, rape reporting and convictions actually went down considerably. But I believe that the previous reforms, which I'll explain more throughout this book, while very well-intentioned, were insufficient and misguided. And even those reforms were still decades behind the times, meaning our modern rape laws are even further behind. All of which is to say, A constellation of social problems have led to the outrages that inspired the Me Too movement. To go back to King's quote that a riot is the language of the unheard, we need to ask ourselves, what have we as a society been failing to hear? The answer is our basic social institutions at every level, from families to schools to the media to the law, have failed to respectfully and satisfactorily address the realities of sexual violence. The only place people who were hurt and hurting found a sympathetic audience was the internet, so that was where they went to vent their understandable anger. But we have to make other more conventional and regulated social institutions become more receptive to these complaints, because at the end of the day, the internet is a very unstable place for managing society and justice. And if we're serious about changing social institutions' attitudes towards sexual violence, we have to take the time to understand how they got the way they did, which I think mostly comes down to two things: a poor delineation of and differentiation between legal and ethical standards, and gender inequality, but probably not in the way you expect. Legal versus ethical standards. After acknowledging so much complexity, ambiguity, and consent, I think it's important to pause and note that there are plenty of stories of sexual violence that aren't ambiguous at all. Whether because person B literally held a gun to person A's head, because person B was in a position of power to threaten and coerce person A, or because person B ignored or deliberately avoided hearing a no, there are legions of appalling stories where person B unquestionably did an immoral and often illegal thing. And by the time we narrow down our scope of consent violations to those that are actually reported to the police, we're pretty sure that the majority of them aren't very ambiguous at all, even if they usually fail to conform to a cultural stereotypical vision of stranger rape at gunpoint in a dark alley. But almost no sexual assaults are ever reported to the police in the first place, and that's true around the world, and still true even if we narrow our focus to rich countries like the United States, Western European nations, and Australia. On the rare occasions when sexual assaults are reported, the police rarely take them seriously. Even more rarely do they make an arrest or bother to examine the rape kits that collect biological evidence to support the reported crime. When the police do make an arrest, the perpetrators are rarely charged in court, and much more rarely found guilty. In fact, in most of the U.S. states I looked at for numbers, in a given year, the number of people found guilty of rape or first-degree sexual assault was often so low that you couldn't really calculate reliable statistics around it. But don't be fooled into thinking that means rape and sexual assault are uncommon. It just means that our criminal justice systems are failing to create justice when it comes to rape and sexual assault. And that failure is both practically and symbolically significant, since it means rapists might, correctly, assume they can do whatever they want with impunity, and it means that it looks like society and the government just don't care. As infuriating and frustrating as these statistics can be, as a society, we need to have some thoughtful debates about what we think constitutes actionable criminal behavior in general, and with regard to sexual violations in particular. Part of why so many sexual assaults are never reported in the first place is that they're committed by someone the victim knows, and sometimes even really likes or loves. If your girlfriend steals $100 from you, are you going to call the police? What about $1,000? $10,000? Your car? Are you going to report her for assault if she slaps you across the face but doesn't seriously injure you? What if she was drunk or on drugs at the time, was clearly in violation of probation or parole, and will immediately be sent to prison if you make that call? While people do get the criminal justice system involved in some of these problems, they often don't, and I personally don't think that's necessarily a problem. A lot of sexual violence comes down to domestic disputes, and the criminal justice system isn't equipped to handle those well. We could imagine a well-developed system of non-criminal support hotlines and social workers, which are probably much better candidates than the police and criminal justice system, for managing many sexual violence and other domestic issues. One of the major arguments I'll be making in this book is that the current cultural and legal conceptualization of rape and sexual assault is much too blunt to encompass the reality of these types of problematic experiences. As we'll discuss more throughout this book, activists originally introduced the term sexual assault to try to counter the specific cultural stranger rape in an alley at gunpoint image associated with the word rape. Depending on whose analysis you believe, this change was possibly successful. But to keep up with the times, I'm proposing a different term and concept, sexual violation, which includes a wide range of non-consensual sexual experiences many of us might reasonably hesitate to label sexual assaults. Much more on this idea in Chapter 9. As a culture, we have developed higher expectations about what sexual consent should look like over time, and our language and laws should reflect those changes. Many Americans still live in states where overt violence is required in order for a non-consensual encounter to meet the standards of rape or sexual assault. And I hope I don't have to work very hard to convince you that non-consensual sex should be illegal. The end. Throughout this book, when I'm discussing existing statistics and laws, I'll use the term sexual assault. But when I'm discussing broad experiences and shifting cultural ideas, as well as proposing new terminology, I'll use sexual violation. Presumably, society believes there are different levels of offenses warranting different types of punishment, whether that punishment is losing your romantic/sexual partner, general social disapprobation, losing your job or being expelled from school, losing custody of your children, fines, or imprisonment. We approach most other criminal-ish offenses with this sense of scale, and it seems reasonable to approach sexual violence the same way. Logically, there must be sexual violations of general moral and ethical standards that warrant some degree of social disapprobation. Sexual violations severe enough that organizations would want to distance themselves from the violator for pragmatic, e.g. safety, symbolic, e.g. this reflects badly on our organization, and or financial, e.g. if we don't fire you, we're going to get sued reasons. And sexual violations serious enough that they warrant intervention from the criminal justice system, again, for pragmatic, symbolic, and financial reasons. Although I think the way the criminal justice system currently treats many victims of sexual violence is appallingly bad, I also think that in a well-organized and orderly society, relatively few sexual violations would be reported to the police, because it's in the best interest of survivors, perpetrators, and society as a whole for those violations to be addressed with counseling and remediation rather than prison, which statistically speaking only occasionally helps survivors feel better and almost never rehabilitates perpetrators. As we consider reforming organized social institutions to address problems of sexual violence, we need to think about the roles that are appropriate for victims/survivors. Should their interests be the central organizing principle for justice, or should we also consider the best interest of perpetrators and society as a whole? For example, do we think that prosecutors should be able to prosecute a crime without the official complaint or support of the victim in general and for sexual violations in particular? I don't have easy answers to those questions because there aren't any, but we'll consider these questions and their social, legal, and philosophical implications from all sides in part two of this book. In general, throughout this book, I want to challenge you to think about the types of sexual violations you think the criminal justice system should get involved with, and the types you think could be better addressed in other ways. I'll also challenge you to think about whether the standards for violations should be the same in a legal versus a social/ethical context. For example, returning to our opening anecdote, we might reluctantly concede that Bob's behavior was legal, since he eventually annoyed Al into agreeing to have sex with him, but we might still deem it socially undesirable and rather unethical. Presumably, in an ideal world, illegal behavior should always be unethical and undesirable, but many undesirable and unethical behaviors don't necessarily have to be illegal. As we consider these standards and laws, we can even imagine them in the context of a utopian system without racism, sexism, or class prejudice before we start dealing with the nitty-gritty realities of what the criminal justice system actually looks like later in part two of this book. But before we do any of that, let's turn to preview the second reason I argued that so many social institutions are unsympathetic towards victims of sexual violence. Gender equality, but probably not in the way you think. Gender chasm and consent. To return yet again to the story of Al and Bob and their many gendered variations, I hope we start to recognize that society and culture often think consent doesn't really mean the same thing for men and women. And if consent means something different when women give it, or don't, versus when men give it, or don't, that logically means we're probably going to have a lot of misunderstandings about what consent looks like in heterosexual interactions. We're even likely to see plenty of misunderstandings in same-sex interactions because so many of the sexual scripts, the sociological term for social rules and expectations of sexual interactions, were written by and for straight people with all their messy ideas about sex and gender. And unsurprisingly, we definitely see those kinds of misunderstandings all over the place. You might be understandably resistant to the word misunderstanding there, since plenty of, and perhaps most, sexual assaults are obviously not good faith misunderstandings. They're willfully committed crimes. Lots of men who sexually violate women haven't misunderstood anything and are just bad people, and many of them are complete assholes to women and to other men as well. If we focus on the kinds of men responsible for aggravated sexual assaults, we find many of them are just violent people in general. But if we look at, for example, the men reported for sexual assault on college campuses, like those profiled in Vanessa Gregoriadis' Blurred Lines 2017, we find many of them just seem like really average human beings who may or may not have done a bad thing. Gregoriadis admitted she was somewhat staggered by how profoundly traumatized many of the accused college men she interviewed were by the idea that they might have violated a woman and/or the perceived unfairness of the accusation. We're used to imagining violators as irredeemably terrible people, and I've certainly personally met a couple in my life who were, but many of them, even the ones who I know for a fact did something wrong, weren't. As shocking as this seems to be for many women, who have often spent an inordinate amount of time in their lives thinking about sexual assault and protecting themselves from it, in my experience, a lot of guys have barely put any thought into it at all. I don't just mean they've spent little time thinking about the possibility of being assaulted. I mean they just haven't really thought much about the idea of sexual assault, period. And if you haven't thought much about the complexities of something, it's dangerously easy to assume it's simple. The vast majority of men seem to understand that good guys aren't rapists, but most of them have just learned to think of rape as you put a gun to her head and your dick in her pussy. Telling them to redefine rape as failing to ask nicely before ripping her clothes off the way they do on the cover of her romance novel, and then making the connection to the thing they themselves did when drunk, may require some serious cultural work. Women, meanwhile, for all that they've often spent a lot of time thinking about how not to get raped themselves, have often put very little thought into how to not sexually violate men or other women. Women learn to think of themselves as unthreatening because society tells them they're physically weaker than men. A phrase people repeat to me so often when I talk about consent that I've wished it could be banned from the language. Yes, women on average are physically weaker than men on many measures, but that doesn't mean they can't use weapons or have deep social power over men to coerce or merely humiliate them. A male friend of mine was literally raped at gunpoint by a woman, and when he complained to the male Canadian police about it, the response was, "Why didn't you take the gun away from her?" Women learn to think of themselves and their physical beings as unthreatening, and men learn to think much the same, with the end result being that people often seem to doubt that a woman even could rape a man. Again, I don't mean to imply that all men view consent and sexual violation in a specific way or that all women do. Rather, I mean that society gives us gendered lenses with which to view these things, and if we want to change the lenses, we generally have to make an effort. Studies show substantial gaps in the way college men and women perceive these issues, but if we had studies with broader samples, I suspect we'd find similar gaps off college campuses too. Until we adjust our lenses to be more similar to one another, we will continue to have messy, spiraling, meandering, angry, and often pointless conversations about the meaning of rape and sexual violation. For so many women, their actual and potential sexual violation by men is a constant threat and reality that permeates their lives and consciousness. But for many men, the things women concern themselves with just don't seem like a big deal at all, because if someone did those things to them, they either wouldn't care or would be happy, with the notable exception that straight men feel theoretically vulnerable to sexual violation by other men. I think many activists advocate for everyone trying to see the world of consent and sexual violation in the terms women do in this context, but I personally think that we'd all probably be better off taking a more informed third path. For their part, women are taught to think of their bodies and emotions as excessively vulnerable and fragile, and to overvalue their bodies and sexual purity. While men are taught to think of themselves as strong and tough and to undervalue their bodies but overvalue sexual experience, many people in each binary gender category don't absorb these norms and values, but they absorb a cultural awareness of them, feel their pressure or gravitational pull, and on some level usually recognize when they don't conform to them. If we want to imagine a gender-free vision for consent and sexual violation, and I think we should imagine one for people who are neither weak nor strong, who are neither fragile nor tough, and who value consensual sexual experiences even when they're bad. The standard should consistently apply regardless of the gender, bodies, or roles of the people involved. But to have sophisticated conversations about those standards, we have to be honest about our gendered and personal standards without simply condemning each other silently or loudly. As you read this book, I ask you to consider your own experiences, biases, and points of reference. What assumptions do you make about words like rape, rapist, consent violation, sexual assault victim, sexual assault survivor, and sexual violence? I don't know what your personal answers are, but I've got some psychological studies that let me guess. And with those guesses at hand, I'm going to ask for your consent, dear reader, to let me violate some of your assumptions and expectations about the context, meaning, and application of those words for the next 9 chapters. On the off chance that you already agree with most of what I'm about to say, I hope I can at least add nuance to your thinking and help you better articulate your ideas. Regardless, I hope this book can change the tone of some of our cultural and legal conversations about sexual consent and assault. But before we dive into the nitty-gritty complexities of gender, the law, and major social change, we need to start with a short history lesson to establish some background and social context. So let's begin with a brief history of rape. I hope that that has been sufficient to whet your appetite to read more of my book, Violated: Sexual Consent and Assault in the 21st Century. Thank you for listening.